Hey, it's Greg Gutfeld. This is the one. I am beyond excited. It's guy that I have up next. Scott Adams refers to as the Godzilla of persuasion. And he's not wrong. I heard about this guy when I listened to a recorded Charlie Munger speech. I think he works at Berkshire Hathaway. Anyway, he talked about how a unique book had altered his perceptions about work and life. And so I thought, well, if this impressed that guy, I'm going to order this book. And then it totally changed the way I looked at things. And it's all about the psychology of persuasion. The book was called Influence. It sold like 3 million copies plus. It's amazing. Now, the author, Dr. Robert Cialdini, has a new book, I think it's out in paperback, called Persuasion, which is also deals with the psychology behind persuasion. Dr. Cialdini, how are you?
I'm well. Glad to be with you and your audience.
Thank you so much. So when I read your books, I've come to the conclusion that what you are dealing with is a superpower. It's basically a superpower that is right in front of everybody and they don't know what it is. Is that accurate?
You know, I think that is remarkably accurate because everybody knows about persuasion. They think they do anyway. Everybody knows about the process of moving somebody else in their direction. They think they do, but they don't recognize how it works at the human level of the tendencies inside all of us that serve as triggers.
Mm-hmm.
That cause us to say yes, to be persuaded.
Mm-hmm. I always talk about, I think when I got the first book, Influence, and I gave it to friends that I work with, I always go, if I had this book, I don't know, 10 years ago, I would have done things differently. I would have done things better. In your new book, Persuasion, examples of persuasion that you mentioned is like in getting people to buy French wine in a liquor store. You play French music, or if you want somebody to react warmly to you, you serve them a warm drink. How would you define persuasion? I mean, what's your definition of it?
Persuasion is the process of getting your audience to agree with your message before they've encountered it.
Mm-hmm.
It's the act of putting your recipient of your message in a state of mind that is consistent with the message they are about to receive,
mm-hmm,
before you deliver it.
Right.
So that when you do deliver your message, it resonates with them,
mm-hmm,
as a consequence of having previously been readied for that message.
Mm-hmm. So it's like you, in one of your subheadings in Persuasion, you say not hocus, not pocus, but focus. That's kind of what you're talking about, right?
Right. You get people to focus on a particular concept,
mm-hmm,
right, before you present them that concept. And that makes that concept much more important to them,
mm-hmm,
when they encounter it. I'll give you an example of a study that was done by Royal Caribbean Cruise Lines.
Mm-hmm.
They sent a promotional email to all their previous customers, and they said, if you book a cruise during the holiday season of this year, right,
mm-hmm,
we will give you a big discount.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Now, half of the people got that message, and when they opened it, mm-hmm, they found a ticking digital clock,
mm-hmm,
saying you only have this many more hours, this many more minutes and seconds to get the deal.
Right.
Right. Half of them got that message. The other half got exactly the same message, except in the subject line were two ticking down clock emojis.
Mm-hmm.
That message produced a several 100% increase in profit.
Wow.
Because before people got to the concept of dwindling availability, they were cued, mm-hmm, to that concept.
Mm-hmm.
Then when they encountered it, it just resonated with them so much more, they followed through and purchased much more of the available cruise stock.
It is, you know, you have in your book, you have tons of examples of these kinds of stories. And it almost, like, when I'm reading this, I feel like, Mike, when I said earlier that it's like a superpower, in the sense that it's kind of evil, because it once you know about this, you can apply it to just about anything. It's kind of like I have adjusted the way I do a monologue every day on The Five, and we have like almost 3 million viewers a day, and I'm hitting a lot of people, and I have adjusted the way I do my monologues after reading your books in terms of like just using the correct pronoun. Like, this is a big deal. You talk about this, and I think this is what Donald Trump is kind of effective with too, is like saying you a lot as opposed to we or them, but saying you.
Yeah, or yes. And so as soon as you hear the pronoun you, mm-hmm. people focus immediately on the thing that's going to happen next, because mm-hmm. that's important to them, right?
Right.
You've just been informed ahead of the next thing that happens that this is relevant to you.
Mm-hmm.
And there's actually something called an orienting response that occurs in the brain
mm-hmm.
whenever there's something like that occurs, where you inform them that this is self-relevant.
Right. Right?
And so you get people leaning in mm-hmm. to the next thing that's said.
Right.
As a consequence.
Yeah. There's a paragraph in your book that, like, struck me. It's in, like, I think it's in the first or second chapter. And it is so obvious, but I never thought about it, which is that you say something like when attention is paid to something, attention is lost to something else. And the idea being that you can only really focus at one thing at a time. And I started to think about that in my life, that I create so much stress in my life by selecting one particular thing to think about, and it fills my brain. And so when you mention that, it's like how easy – if you can pay attention to something – you can also shift attention away from something, which is something that we forget to do when something is bothering us. Does that make sense at all?
That is a bullseye insight.
Thank you.
Right there. That is, we only get to have one thing in attention at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And that thing that is at top of consciousness guides the behavior in the next moment.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That means that as a communicator, if we can get somebody to pay attention to a particular concept, like dwindling availability, right?
Mm-hmm.
Everything else, like price and convenience, all those things go away,
right,
compared to the importance of dwindling availability.
Mm-hmm. You know, I did an experiment on Twitter. I have a book coming out in a couple of months, and I tweeted out, you know, the link to Amazon, and my message was only one per order. It's so ridiculous. It is so absurd. But I read your book, and it's like I'm going, okay, dwindling availability. What would happen if I write only one per order? When obviously
right.
it's not that you can order at Amazon as many as you want.
Right.
But I just thought maybe it'll work. I don't know.
Well, you know what? Your intuition was right, because there was a study done by a large supermarket chain, and they looked at all the promotions that they had run for their various brands on the shelves over the years.
Mm-hmm.
And there was one that stood above all the others in terms of effectiveness. A sign on the shelf that said, only three per customer.
Mm-hmm.
It was double
yeah.
the effect of any other promotion they had run.
Mm-hmm. It's amazing how just subtle, simple changes can alter perceptions and persuasion and influence people. There are two kinds of – you mentioned two kinds of persuasion in advertising that they're different, but you use them at different times. One is the human being has a desire to stand out, but they also have a desire to be part of a group.
Right.
How does that play into pairing like an ad with a TV show or an ad with, like, let's say there's an ad for the my show, The Five, and it's happening during a volatile, scary period in our country.
Yeah.
The ad would, you would play upon the need to belong, because that's,
right.
But if it was good times, maybe you would play on the need to stand out. Am I close?
Yes, you are, and especially in the first half of it, because my research team and I did a study like that where we gave people an ad for the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art, right? And some of them got that ad immediately after watching a scary movie that we showed them, right? And if we said in the ad for the museum, visited by over a million people a year, in other words, belong with the crowd,
right,
the intention to visit the museum skyrocketed, because when they're scared, you want to be in a crowd.
Right.
There's safety in numbers, right?
Exactly.
Well, that translated it to the idea of, if you are anxious or fearful or concerned, give people evidence that a lot of others are doing something, and they will move in that direction much more than if you gave them evidence of some other kind of psychological reason for joining or for attending and visiting that place.
And so if they – and conversely, if they saw a romantic comedy, you would – the ad would be – directed at standing out, because standing out would get you a romantic partner.
Exactly. When you are involved, when you've just experienced and you've paid attention to romance, right? Well, in a romantic situation, you want to stand out from your rivals, right? So the ad that we had for the museum, if we said, be one of the few in your group who has visited the museum. That's the thing that caused the big willingness to attend. If they had seen a romantic comedy right before the ad, give them a piece of evidence that indicates that you can stand out by choosing this place, this product, this service.
You know, I want to talk about about issues in general and how your research could impact like things that are going on in the world, because I remember an amazing study or a piece of research in your earlier book, I think it was Influence, Not Persuasion, where you documented a dramatic increase in airplane crashes following a publicized report of a suicide, or a well-publicized suicide, and they saw these. And I am a firm believer that where I, you know, in my business, cable news has been part of, I don't know, increasing mass shootings purely through the publicizing of them and the enlarging the scope. And I really feel that we are playing a role in creating infamy. Is that – am I – from your research to my conclusion, is that – am I close?
You're right again. It's not my research. It was done at University of California at San Diego. A sociologist there found
– it's amazing. That fact. Yeah, I'm sorry, I'm interrupting. But can you explain? It's like, how can airplane crashes increase? I mean, how do you explain this?
The way it explained is that those subsequent airplanes. So if you see a story of a suicide, right, and then you see an increase in airplane crashes, it turns out those airplane crashes were secret suicide.
Wow. That is amazing.
People in private planes,
right,
diving into the ground. People in we've even had this, people in private planes plowing into commercial airlines.
Jeez.
Right.
Yeah.
Those kinds of things, you can track exactly how that happens. The big increase, because it's not a mysterious connection between suicides and airplane crashes that may be due to the pilots being upset by reading the story of a famous suicide. No.
No.
It's somebody else deciding,
right.
Oh, if that person committed suicide, if that troubled individual chose suicide, and I'm a troubled individual, that tells me that's what I should do.
It is. It plants. It's that. It goes back to what we just talked about. It's a almost like persuasion. It,
yeah.
The news report of a suicide plants the idea. So if you were maybe you were already depressed or unhappy, financially or romantically, the persuasion of this reported event sets it up, and it has, to me, this has so many implications for the media. I know that the police do not like it when people report on teen suicides, precisely because of what you're talking about. Yet we go totally crazy when it comes to a mass shooting. We will go 24 hours nonstop, and I just worry that is. And then you hear about these shooters who collect press clippings of previous shootings.
Precisely.
And it's just, to me, it's like I feel that there's research here that is telling us to stop.
Yeah. So I think the key is it's news, right?
Yeah.
You have to present it to the public. It's news. What you can't do is sensationalize it.
Right.
You can't tease it out for, like you said, 24/7 for a week. Just because it gets you viewers.
Yeah.
No, the news is out there. You've communicated. That's the end.
Yeah.
For a responsible media representative, then.
Yeah. It's hard because everybody sees what everybody else is doing.
Yeah.
And so they feel that they have to do the same thing, and but we have the research there that says this is a problem. Do you see any role in, like, if you look at the world now, we hear a lot about the problems of tribalism. Everybody's, like, picking their own team. They're in their own kind of bubble of confirmation bias.
Yeah.
Are there any – I mean, do you see ways in which – and this isn't your role or your job, but is there a role for persuasion, pre-persuasion, in kind of reducing this – I don't know – this disunity, because we know that humans like unity, but we're living in a world where there's so much lack of unity.
Yeah. There are two ways, it seems to me. One is to raise the commonalities between peoples, including different tribes. Right.
Yeah.
We are a lot more like one another than we are different. So if we focus on that, make that the thing at the top of consciousness when people go into interactions with one another, that will lend itself to a more favorable outcome.
Mm-hmm.
The other is a new piece of research. At least it's new to me. I hadn't seen this. One of the great conflicts of our time, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, right? It's not just a debate.
Yeah.
It's an ongoing conflict.
Mm-hmm.
There's a colleague of mine at Stanford University. He's a negotiation researcher, and he goes over to that area of the Middle East every year and tries different kinds of strategies to get Palestinians and Israelis to come together and agree on a way forward, a step to take.
Mm-hmm.
And he writes about a study that he did where he said, look, to a group of Israelis and a group of Palestinians who came in to negotiate on how to use a certain amount of money that the researchers said, okay, look, we're going to give you as a group a certain amount of money, and your job is to come to an agreement on how to allocate that money there in the West Bank.
Right.
whether it should go to increased security for Israel, whether it should go to increased education for Palestinians, whatever, you know, there are various ways, and you guys have to come to an agreement. If you don't, you lose all the, nobody gets the money. Under those circumstances, they get miserable levels of agreement.
Right.
Over 70% walk away with nobody getting any money. Neither of their sides is is benefited, right?
Right.
Unless they do one thing before they begin. They say, you know, this is going to be a difficult negotiation, but we've found that in the past, most of our groups do come to an agreement. And now they get 85%. By telling them this is feasible.
Yes.
Look, when you come to a hard spot here, don't just throw up your hands and walk away. It's possible to work through this. Other groups have done it.
Yeah.
Right? You can do it too.
Who does this sound? This sounds like North Korea. Does it, I mean, I'm thinking about this. As you were talking about this, I'm nodding my head. And I'm going like, you know, you hear Trump go, hey, we'll see what happens. There's going to be some bumps in the road. But who knows? It could happen. The idea of admitting that it's difficult at the start, but it's still feasible. I mean, is that, am I making a...
I think saying this is... This could be difficult at the start is a brilliant way to start.
Yeah.
Because you're admitting that, hey, I'm not the Superman here.
Yeah.
I'm not, I mean, this may not happen.
Yeah.
I can't command it to happen.
Yeah.
But then to say, here's what I would add to what you just said. Instead of saying, hey, it may happen, what you have to say is in the past in situations, very difficult negotiations, people have been able to pull it out.
Right.
It's possible to do this, to overcome the barriers of long, entrenched, difficult negotiations. Right. It's happened in the. That's what these guys from Stanford did in the Middle East. They said, look, it's going to be tough. But it's possible. It's feasible. We have a history of that happening in comparable negotiations.
So
we have to be able to say, look, we can point to other negotiations in other parts of the world where nobody thought it was going to happen. Those people stayed at it, and they triumphed.
Do you think – I mean, I read your books. I'm watching – like, in fact, I wrote a couple of articles – in which I talk about your book in relationship to Trump's what I used to think was gimmickry, but I realized that he was using certain negotiating tactics that I hadn't actually noticed before. And I see that whatever you think about Donald Trump, whether you find him crass or just, you know, just an unusual person, there seems to be a toolkit that is filled with different kind of persuasive elements, like the free offer. He always tends to, from what I noticed, to give something away first. I noticed this with media, that he would show up and do talk shows because he knew that somewhere down the line you were going to have to pay him back on that. So you do. He did a lot of morning TV here, and then when he decided to run, he had places to go. And then when I look at like North Korea. You know, I see him basically making North Korea feel like they already gained something and they'll have something to lose if they back out. And I think that's – you've talked about that. It's like making sure somebody feels that they have something to lose, not something to gain, but they have something to lose. Am I – go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, this idea of loss aversion being stronger than the desire to gain the very same thing won the Nobel Prize in economics a few years ago for a man named Daniel Kahneman.
Right.
It's the idea that losing the very same thing is much more psychologically mobilizing and motivating than gaining that thing.
Yeah.
right? You take the same there's what he showed, for example, take a unit of value, a dollar. Mm-hmm. For each new dollar you get, right, you feel somewhat more satisfied, mm-hmm. right? If you gain it. For every dollar you lose, you feel substantially more disappointed at that loss mm-hmm. than you did for that gain of the very same thing if it was being given to you.
Yeah.
Somebody taking away a dollar makes you crazy mm-hmm. to avoid that possibility. Yeah.
Yeah. I know I've kept you on for almost a half an hour, but I have so many things. Do you do any work in politics? I've looked at your immense resume. I mean, you've worked with so many companies. Do you ever work in politics? Have you?
I used to, and I don't anymore. It's mm-hmm. so time consuming.
Yeah.
And to be honest, Greg, I just lose control of the information. And I just don't get to say, hey, this is how you should use this.
Right.
Once it's taken.
Oh, my God. I would hire, if I was running, I probably couldn't afford you, but I would hire you as my campaign director, because I see what you mean. I think that people running for office might not listen to you because they would just go, no, this is, you know, because they're so used to doing things the old way,
right.
Which is, you know, it's like, and also to your point about the Israel-Palestinian conflict, that what you're talking about is something that is almost against the old way. The old way is don't talk to the guys that you're in a fight with. It's like, don't talk to North Korea. Israel and Palestine, they will always be enemies. What you're talking about is something in the negotiating world, in the sales world, that you talk to everybody. And you talk to everybody, and bringing somebody to the table doesn't necessarily mean that you're elevating evil. It's just that that's what you do. And I have a feeling that politicians probably would not be able to grasp what you're talking about because of that. Although, I have to say, I think Trump, and I don't know if you agree or disagree with me on this, Trump won in part because of all of these things that you talk about
yeah.
in your books.
No, he was brilliant. There was one thing he did that I thought was so smart mm-hmm. and persuasive. When he began his campaign, he was drawing big crowds.
Yeah.
Even before he was considered by most to be a legitimate candidate for the presidency, right?
Right.
He was drawing big crowds. And what he would do at those rallies, he'd say to the media, turn the cameras around. Before I say a word, mm-hmm. show the size of the crowd.
Yeah.
What that told the television audience that was viewing, look at all these people who've come here to hear what I have to say. Mm-hmm. It probably makes sense for you to listen.
Yeah, it worked. It worked. I mean, there's so many other little things that he did that I'm going through my notes because I know I've kept you long, but there's this great little fact that I want to leave, that I want to end on, and it's about how women are twice as likely to friend a man on Facebook if he claims to have the same birthday.
Right.
And you link this also to how Coca-Cola sold like 200 million more cans by putting people's names on it. And I yeah. find this is so sneaky that this is like persuasion can be good and it could be evil. That like all guys have to do now is just if they see a cute girl on Facebook, all they have to do is say, hey, I have the same birthday as you. It's like.
Right. Yeah, and that, you know what, it goes back to what we were saying about here's what you do in a negotiation. Focus on the ways that we're similar.
Yeah.
It just, you give people grace.
Right.
As a consequence.
Yeah, it's true. Dr. Cialdini, your books are amazing. And the new one, it's not a new one. Is it just coming out as?
It came out in paperback yesterday.
Okay.
It's called Persuasion.
Yeah. And it's amazing. And it's so heavily footnoted. It's got like 100 pages of footnotes. So it's one of those books that. It's like I would call it a mass market business book. It'd be like a book that you see at the airport. But the only difference is you have to read this one. This isn't a book that you just like read to pass the time. If you read this book or Influence, you kind of walk away going, I just got the key to a universe. There's like a the influence book is just torn to shreds with ink and because I just keep finding new things in it, and they're incredibly valuable resources. So Dr. Cialdini, thanks for spending some time with me.
Well, you know, I'm going to say thank you to you for the care that you took with the research, and you clearly read these books and were equipped to ask the questions that led to good answers. That's not always the case, believe me.
I know what you mean. I've been interviewed over my books by people who haven't read them, and all they do is trash Fox News. It's like I go – I never interview somebody unless I've read their book and I'm genuinely interested and admire the work, because it's just – why not? Why, if I have the opportunity to talk to somebody that is doing something important, you know, I'm going to read it and I'm going to make sure I read every word. So it was my pleasure.
Great.
Thank you, sir.
All right.
Take care.
So long for now.